do you give the horse its might? One can find God's description of the horse not only in Scripture, but in the locker room of an East Mississippi community college. This can be found in a documentary called Last Chance U. The show follows the lives of collegiate football players who enroll in the hopes of one last shot to transfer and play for a Division I program. One of the assistant coaches, Marcus Wood, begins an episode by reading these verses of the horse to the team. As he reads them, the camera cuts to an image of a section of these verses written in bold white letters on one of the red pillars in the locker room. The pronoun it is replaced with he. The pillar reads, "He laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. He does not shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against his side, along with the flashing spear and lance. In frenzied excitement, he eats up the ground. He cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds." When the coach is finished, he addresses his players. "That's how the horse is built. Now, if God makes the horse to do that, the horse conquers things, then what can you do? What can you conquer?" Well, from our perspective, it seems the horse is ready to conquer a lot, just about anything. God does not mince words in describing this animal to Job. It is eager to strike terror, paw fiercely, eat up the ground in a frenzied excitement. God makes it clear the horse craves the thrill of the fight as it laughs in the face of quivers, spears, and lances. But is this what comes to mind when we think of horses? A fearless, mighty wrecking machine ready to dominate whatever stands in its path. I'm no equestrian, but I think we've come to understand horses a little differently than the grandiose imagery supplied in Job. If you've ever spent any time on a farm or wilderness center, you might pick up a different impression of the animal. And while horses possess great physical strength, you may come to understand them as a more calm and gentle creature. In terms of how horses are portrayed in the media, novels and films often explore the emotional journeys between horses and their human companions, such as The Black Stallion and The Horse Whisperer. Horses are actually fascinatingly in tune with human emotions. Numerous studies have shown that horses possess a high level of emotional intelligence and can even be incorporated into a type of mental health therapy. Equine-assisted therapy has been used to help individuals with social and emotional skills and even with deeper traumas such as those with PTSD. The Equine-Assisted Growth and Learning Association explains that the survival of a horse depends on their extreme sensitivity to their environment, which naturally gives them the ability to instinctively read our body language and nonverbal cues. With careful observation, we discover that the horse exhibits more strengths and skills, more skills than strength alone. However, the horse we have come to know is not blindly unabashed in the midst of danger. The animal is wondrously attuned to it. But in the text, of course, we don't get the highly sensitive and emotionally instinctive horse. We get the horse that leaps like a locust and snorts proudly. We get the horse that conquers things. The text seems to narrow the traits of the horse down to those that increase its sense of powerfulness. The traits are so bombastic that they perhaps seem to counter the actual feelings of the horse in order to produce a larger-than-life image of supreme aggression and dominance. A creature that does not fear, but conquers things. So the coach turns to his players and asks what they can do, what they can conquer. "Are you also strong and fearless, like the mighty horse?" For the young men in the room, this is a message they have surely heard before. It is a message many young men receive from an early age: strength and dominance, two key traits for a successful life. Like the grand image of the brawny horse, men in our society are told to be fearless. Men are still instilled with the idea that life demands a constant display of strength. However, what is emphasized is not strength in the inclusive sense. It is a restricted and sadly limited view of what strength means, of what masculinity means. The Liturgist podcast points out this disconnect between men and changing society. They say, for the last 100 years or so, we've been renegotiating the social contract, and it's creating a new sense of identity for people. Women's liberation and the feminist movements, womanism, and LGBTQ+ advocacy, praise be to God. These are all amazing developments in society that we should celebrate. But something has been missing as we've renegotiated the social contract. There is no new script for men. Men are still working with an ancient script where they're supposed to be in charge and stoic and self-efficient at all costs. And among the many consequences of that is this loneliness and alienation and desperation. We're finding that men today in America who are in their 50s and 60s often report having no close friendships, feeling unable to be in close relationships, even with their spouse. The issue is not an attack on masculinity in itself, but the cultural construction of it, what it is supposed to look like. The cold reality is that our American cultural model of masculinity still portrays strength on the misguided notions of athletic ability, wealth, and sexual conquest. From as early as the age of 4 and 5, young boys learn that fitting in depends on repressing emotions like sadness, fear, and even joy. Our own cultural reality does not allow boys and men to simply feel comfortable with themselves, so they are instilled with the idea that they must prove their worth. Strength and dominance lead many men to believe their value is equated with athletic ability, by conquering others on a football field. Yes, sports can be a tremendous place to hide. Men also arrive at the belief that certain professions are more masculine than others, with young boys dreaming of becoming star athletes and venture capitalists, suppressing ideal vocations and talents that others might think are not masculine enough. Psychologist Carol Gilligan points out young boys begin to adhere to these narrow constructs from an early age as they begin to censor themselves from even the age of 5. Sadder yet, through the notion that life hinges on controlling people and circumstances, many men become consciously or subconsciously convinced that they are entitled to the bodies of women. In this way, they spread misogynistic and patriarchal norms, normalizing a shockingly low standard for men, in which sexual assault has become an inevitability rather than an atrocity. This narrow and toxic metric creates painful consequences for everyone, yet rarely receives any attention. It is also important to know that many intersections between sexism, racism, and white supremacy exist in this manner. We do not have the time to adequately explore these at the moment, but they need to be acknowledged. It is also important to note toxic masculinity is neither an excuse for behavior nor a complete explanation for the many issues described, but it certainly plays a part. However, like the horse, when we take a deeper look into the lives of men, when we can look beyond the veil of forced external machismo, we see something more. God's reality paints a different picture than what is expressed within gender constructs. Men experience deep emotion, emotion that despite cultural messages is not a hindrance, but a valuable component of the humanity of creation. Emotion that enhances, not detracts. We know that men possess more talents and gifts than merely athletic ability and strength that only fits in a superficial sense of hollow bravado. Men can care for the elderly. Men can have meaningful and nurturing relationships with children and can and should have respectful relations with others. Men can have quality friendships with other men. Again, with careful observations, the capacity for men is much, much greater than merely strength and dominance. So where does that leave us? Where do we turn and search for this more inclusive and realistic model of masculinity? Luckily, there have been efforts now to challenge these traditional and toxic norms as men have come to realize there is a great need to change. But as usual, there has been pushback from men, of course. An argument I've continued to see comes as the form of a question: why is masculinity under attack? In the need to look beyond these damaging narratives, I've always wondered what the parts of masculinity are that we are so afraid of losing. For me, I don't think it's a push for boys to stop playing sports or running outside, but the need to re-examine how we are telling them to behave, how we are shaping our identity as humans. While these arguments point out the disconnect, they fail to identify behavior that should not be normalized. Furthermore, it is important to look at men's fear of effeminacy, as rigid gender constructs have created a kind of paranoia against the boys we men think are too soft. This can be seen at very young ages. Political scientist and educator Caroline Heldman describes this phenomenon with masculinity as the great setup. We raise boys whose very identity is based on rejecting the feminine, she says. Then we act surprised when they don't see women as being fully human. Every 9 seconds, a woman is assaulted, yet we worry men are growing too soft. This can also, of course, overlap into the discrimination of those in the LGBTQ+ community. Sadly, when we turn to the church to speak to this, we know it has been painfully absent historically in its attempts to transform the narrowness of society's image of men. In the West, the church continues to operate largely on the idea that men are defined by many of the same traits as our culture: strength and superiority. This is the structural embedding of patriarchal norms. Men are expected to stoically lead, and although they experience greater positions of power, they still serve under a restricted lens, working only in the culturally appropriate positions, offering the gifts only men are supposed to offer. Sadly, we know the history of women's value in the church is measured by whether they are married or not, and by many other painfully restrictive factors. The church's complicity and reinforcement of the narrowness of gender is not only a sad reality, it is something that represses the gifts and graces of God's people. Luckily, things are changing. Not only are we seeing more and more women and diverse leadership in the church, thank God, we are starting to see men interrogate toxic masculinity. For the child who feels the need to censor himself at a young age. For the boy who feels shame for not being good enough in sports. For the teenager who suffers in silence because he thinks his problems are a deficiency and a burden to those around him. For the husband who hides his tears from his partner. For a safer world for everyone. While many continue to insist on doubling down in favor of traditional masculinity, here in the church we can model a vision that does not minimize and confine each other to flawed metrics. In God's changing world, we can use our voices to challenge the toxic cultural and institutional constructs that have become so poisonously pervasive and develop faithful cooperative strategies that extend the love of Christ to all, rejoicing in each other's traits and talents. We can begin to live outside of the narrow lens of society and live into the radical idea of embracing each other as we are. Perhaps God's church offers a response to society's crude understanding and categorization of God's children. So what about the horse then? When we return to the text with this holistic vision in mind, when we return to God's depiction of the charging horse and its fierce snarl, we do not have to condemn the verses for portraying a limited view of an animal. For we know the horse is not only defined by its strength. We can still marvel at the power of the horse, just as we can marvel at its other characteristics, without the confining and limiting. The horse shares in the vast wonder of God's diverse creation, just as we must share amongst each other in the midst of our wealth of blessings. So is this still the horse that conquers things? It may still be, but perhaps it exists beyond our own surface impression. Rather than a raging beast prepared to ravage whatever lies in its path, the horse models a vital tenacity. It is a tenacity that we need to begin to implement in the intimidating work of change. The horse rejoices in God's gifts, just as we are called to rejoice in ours. The horse charges into the fray with the fierceness we need to confront our issues, to confront our narrowness. It can catch the scent of battle. It can sniff out and uncover the conflicts that are in dire need of addressing. It does not shy away from the sword in the midst of tension, in the midst of adversity, in the midst of oppression. The horse models what we need to create as an honest place for us to wrestle and take the powerful risks that attempt to pierce through noxious human narrowness. The horse cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds, when the call to do God's work echoes throughout our very being. The horse cannot help but become stirred, and neither should we. Praise be to God.